From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Don Cheadle. In Traffic, he played a DEA agent. In Boogie Nights, he was Buck, a porn actor who loved country music. In the HBO Rat Pack movie, he portrayed Sammy Davis Jr., and in Devil in a Blue Dress, he was a trigger-happy ex-con. Now he plays a teacher in a juvenile hall in the new film The United States of Leland. The Showtime series The L Word, about a group of lesbians and their friends and lovers, has been renewed for a new season. This season's finale is April 11th. We'll talk with the creator, Eileen Chaikin, and one of the stars of the series, Jennifer Beals. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists, 1854 to 1967. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Pentagon officials say at least a dozen U.S. Marines have been killed in new fighting in the Iraqi town of Ramadi. NPR's Eric Westervelt says the town has been known as dangerous, but this is a new level of violence.
Ramadi's been quiet in recent weeks, but certainly throughout the months of the occupation, Ramadi has been a hot spot for the Iraqi insurgency and for opposition to the U.S. Occupation. U.S. officials believe several cells were operating in and around Ramadi, and certainly opposition continues there. But we hadn't seen this kind of attack with this kind of casualties in Ramadi at all throughout the occupation.
The Ramadi attack came as U.S. Marines fought their way into the nearby town of Fallujah. Meanwhile, followers of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr fought with foreign troops in several Iraqi cities. Sadr has vowed to continue the uprising until U.S.-led forces withdraw from Iraq and release prisoners. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Baghdad.
U.S. troops have long faced daily attacks in the Sunni Muslim heartlands to the north and west of Baghdad, but violence in Shiite Muslim areas represents a new front for the occupying troops, and forces from Italy, Britain, and Ukraine came under attack today. Aides to Muqtada Sadr say the radical cleric has moved to the holy city of Najaf, taking up residence near one of the most sacred Shiite shrines. U.S. officials have said they will arrest him, but Sadr's militiamen paraded openly through Najaf today, apparently convinced U.S. troops will not dare enter the city. Such a move could spark a massive Shiite backlash. The mainstream Shiite leader, Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, issued no public comments today on the spiraling violence. Ann Garrels, NPR News, Baghdad.
President Bush repeated today that the latest violence in Iraq will not alter his resolve to hand political power to an Iraqi government by June 30th. Speaking in Cincinnati, John Kerry challenged President Bush's foreign policy. Ann Thompson reports from member station WVXU.
Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry says the U.S. is losing respect and influence across the planet because of poor decisions by the White House.
And I think this president has run the most arrogant, inept, reckless, ideological foreign policy in the modern history of our country.
Speaking to 800 people at a Cincinnati rally, Kerry promised to return the U.S. to the U.N. without ceding security to any other country or institution. He says multilateralism is strength, not weakness. The Bush administration says liberating Iraqis from a ruthless dictator was important, and now we need to stay the course and finish the mission. For NPR News, I'm Ann Thompson in Cincinnati.
In stocks, the Dow gained 12 points today to close at 10,570. The NASDAQ lost 19 to close at 2059. This is NPR News. The state of Illinois will express official regret tomorrow to the Mormon Church for persecuting Latter-day Saints in the 1840s. Chicago Public Radio's Jason DeRose reports.
Mormon founder Joseph Smith was murdered in Nauvoo, Illinois in 1844. 2 years later, his followers were expelled from the state. Illinois Lieutenant Governor Pat Quinn is leading the delegation to Utah to offer the official regret for those events.
I don't think it's going to be a day of resentment or bitterness or recrimination. I think it's actually an opportunity for reconciliation. We need to be a shining city on a hill for the rest of the world when it comes to religious tolerance.
Quinn and other officials will meet with the president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the governor of Utah at a ceremony in Salt Lake City. Illinois lawmakers approved the expression of regret earlier this year. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Chicago.
A military court in Jordan has sentenced 8 men to death for their part in the murder of an American aid official. The killing took place in October of 2002 when militants shot and killed Lawrence Foley, an administrator for the U.S. Agency for International Development, outside his home in Amman. Only 5 of the 11 defendants in the case are in custody. 2 of those were given the death penalty, 2 received prison sentences, and 1 was acquitted. 6 other men, including Abu Musab Zarqawi, were sentenced to death in absentia. The U.S. government is offering a $10 million reward for information leading to the capture of Zarqawi, who's suspected of being a leader in the al-Qaeda terrorist network. In stocks, the S&P 500 lost 2 points to close at 1148. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is actor Don Cheadle. In the film Traffic, he played an agent of the Drug Enforcement Administration. In Boogie Nights, he played a porn actor who loved country music and called himself Buck. In Ocean's 11, he was a pipe bomb specialist. In the HBO movie The Rat Pack, he played Sammy Davis Jr. And in Devil in a Blue Dress, he was Mouse, an ex-con on a short fuse. Now he's starring in the new movie The United States of Leland as Pearl, a teacher in a juvenile hall. He's taken a special interest in his student Leland Fitzgerald, who is awaiting trial for murder. Pearl is trying to counsel Leland and help him understand his own actions. Pearl is also considering writing a book about Leland. Leland's father is a famous novelist, played by Kevin Spacey. The novelist has come to town to see his son, and in this scene, he meets with Pearl at a hotel bar.
I work at the juvenile hall where Leland's being detained.
How's he holding up?
He's fine. Well, you know, he's in special handling, so he's isolated now.
Can you get me in to see him?
Oh, I don't have that kind of juice. I'm just a teacher there. Visiting day's next Sunday, if you want to...
You don't think I'm aware of that? Did he do it?
I'm not really allowed to talk about that outside of the facility.
Perhaps he told you something.
Yeah. Yeah, he says he did it. But I don't know why.
Don Cheadle, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, your father worked as a psychologist with children and teenagers. Were you able to draw on his experiences at all?
Not really, because he wouldn't talk about them. I mean, only in very vague general sense did he ever talk about his clients or his, you know, his work. He was very sort of devout about the whole client, you know, doctor privilege, and he never revealed anything that he specifically spoke with about any of his clients. It's more a manner that he has and more just a general way that he discussed problems and tries to get to the root of things that I think, you know, rubs off on me.
You went to the California Institute of the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it sounds like you had a great drama teacher in high school. Early in your career, you had a regular part on the television series Fame, based on the movie Fame. How did high school for the performing arts and the TV series compare to the drama class life that you were used to in high school?
Well, I wasn't a regular on that show. I did a two-part, you know, one early in the year and one much later in that same season.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I even got attached to Fame was one of my college suite mates, Jesse Borrego, who played Jesse on the show and still one of my great friends today, we all went to this open call where they, you know, they're looking out of 3,000 people, they cast 2 people, and it was Jesse Borrego and Nia Peoples. And Jesse was, in his inimical way, didn't leave any contact information. All he had was a snapshot. So they were literally putting his picture on the news saying, have you seen this person? If you have seen this person, please tell him to call in because, you know, he has a job. So people were coming up to us at school going, I just saw your picture on the news. And we're like, yeah, right. You know, he didn't believe it. And then finally they tracked him down and took him down there. So that's kind of how I got involved with that, just from, you know, going to the set with him and hanging around and meeting the people that were on the set.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Don Cheadle, and he's starring in the new movie, The United States of Leland. The role that really got you a lot of attention early in your career and won you an award from the Los Angeles Film Critics is your role in Devil in a Blue Dress, which is a film adaptation of a Walter Mosley Private Eye novel, you know, with the main character Easy Rollins, who in the movie was played by Denzel Washington, and you played Easy's old friend Mouse, who's an ex-con and is quite crazy and really kind of gets off on violence.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, let me play a scene from that movie. In this scene, Easy is on the floor with a guy holding a knife to his throat, and the guy's already started cutting. He's already bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
And then you walk in. This is a surprise. You walk in as Mouse, and you pull out a gun. The guy drops his knife. And then Easy wants to kind of question him and get to the bottom of the story, but no, you shoot him and he runs away. So let's hear that scene.
Where's Daphne Monet, Frank? All right, maybe you don't know where she is, but hey, we can help each other find her, man.
You heard, Doug.
Mouse, no!
College resident.
No.
Nah, he's busy right now. You're gonna have to call back.
Look, a rich man is willing to pay $1,000 just to talk to this girl. $1,000, that's a hell of a lot of money, man. Frank.
Wait. Look, let me try. Now, look here, Frank. It's Frank, right?
Yeah.
Frank?
What the hell are you? You ain't got on my way now. Let go of me. Frank, man. Damn it. What the hell is wrong with you, man? Don't you ever grab me when I got a gun in my hand.
That's Denzel Washington and my guest Don Cheadle in a scene from Devil in a Blue Dress. How did you feel about taking this role, given how skeptical you were of all the kind of crime roles that were available to you at that time? Did this one seem qualitatively different?
Well, it was. I mean, it was a great writing piece and a great director, Carl Franklin, and Denzel, great actor to work with. It was a no-brainer. And he was he wasn't just a pat sort of cookie-cutter character. That's the other thing about Mouse, is he wasn't these bad television, portrayals of Gangster X. He was sort of a complex and interesting person to me, which is always fun to play. And I don't mind playing a character like that as long as they have shades, So often these roles that I was talking about that we were offered earlier, they were just the guy that was there to hold the gun and, in this scene, scare this white woman, or in this scene, you're being chased by you were more a function than you were a character. And Mouse was very much a character.
How did your portrayal of Mouse change your career and the kind of roles that you were offered?
There were some people who wanted me to come, be a psychopath in their movie. And I kind of just rejected those roles because a lot of them were, again, underdeveloped and not as well realized with in the hands of people who weren't as talented as Carl. I just thought this is not going to be anywhere near the same sort of we're not going to get anywhere near the same sort of product. And I don't need to start going down that road, getting typecast as that. So I strayed away from that. Like right after Devil, I think I did Boogie Nights and I did Volcano and I did Rosewood. And I remember I did 5 movies that next year. And they were all very different roles and they were all very different characters, which is really exciting, to me. But I think it did sort of put my name out there in a way that hadn't happened before.
Boogie Nights is such a great film. This is Paul Thomas Anderson's film that's set in the pornography trade in, it's the 80s, isn't it? The 70s or the 80s? I can't
70s,
remember.
80s, it spans
yeah,
both.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you play this character named Buck because you love country music. And sometimes kind of dress in country kind of clothes. And you're mm-hmm. one of the porn actors, but you also sell audio equipment. And I'm going to mm-hmm. play a scene where you're selling audio. You're in the store selling audio to a customer. Here you are.
This is hi-fi. okay? High fidelity. You know what that means? That means this is the highest quality fidelity. High five. Those are two very important things to have in the stereo system.
What's the price for the 420?
I have this very unit in my home.
Really?
Yes, I do. But of course, I got it modified with the TK421, which kicks it up another, I don't know, maybe three or four quads per channel, you know. But that's technical talk. That doesn't really concern you. You're still a little uncertain, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what you need? You need a test drive. That's what you need. You need a test drive. I mean, it's one thing to hear it from Buck's mouth. It's another thing to hear it from the TK421. So let me just pop in this 8-track, and you just give a listen, tell me what you think, okay? Woo! Huh. You hear that? You hear the bass, right? You hear it? It kicks. It turns. It curls up your belly. Makes you want to freaky deaky, right?
That's my guest Don Cheadle in a scene from Boogie Nights. That is such a great scene. I love the three or four quads per channel. Like, yeah, what the heck are quads per channel?
That was the most fun, sitting on the set with Paul and going, now what is the exact wrong thing? What's the most perfect, incorrect thing for you to say? And trying to come up, well, should it be, you know, quads per, what is it, channels per? So when we lit up on quads per channel, it was like, yeah, go do that. Go say that.
There's a great scene toward the end of Boogie Nights in which you're buying donuts. And, you know, you're choosing two of the chocolates and two of the old fashions. And suddenly this guy walks in with a big gun, and it's an armed robbery. And another guy shoots him, and everybody's dead except for you. Their blood is all over your clothes. But, you know, watching your face in that scene is really interesting because you're just like, oh, boy, the chocolate donuts. And then you're watching in shock and fear as all the stuff happens around you, and you're trying to kind of make yourself invisible, which you can't really do. Can you talk a little bit about shooting that scene?
That was a donut shop, I believe, on Magnolia Boulevard, or one of the big, you know, valley streets, east-west streets. And it was just Paul, another one of these Paul's visions where he just was, how can we put this guy in a situation where he can come up, but he had nothing to do with it. He's the hapless victim of something. But then, you know, because at the end of that scene, obviously he gets that money that was this guy was trying to rob, and he takes it. And it was that whole moral question of should he take the money, should he not? And he does that real long push in to Buck as he's standing there thinking about what to do, mm-hmm. you know, and he's in his sort of moral dilemma about is this right or wrong, and kind of forgets that he's got bodies all around and blood all over him, and goes, hey, I can get my store. And I just think it's great because it's really convoluted and very jangly. Things don't make sense, but it makes perfect sense, which is the kind of what Paul does the best, you know.
My guest is actor Don Cheadle. He stars in the new movie, The United States of Leland. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Don Cheadle. His films include Traffic, Ocean's 11, The Rat Pack, Boogie Nights, and Devil in a Blue Dress. He stars in the new movie, The United States of Leland. You're, I think, about 5'7". Do I have that right?
5'8".
5'8".
And a half. Thank you very much.
Excuse me. I think you can use your size to different effects. I mean, you're very muscular. And in some roles, like in Boogie Nights, you could have a kind of physically vulnerable look. And then in roles like Traffic or Out of Sight, you can look really strong and able to use that strength. Can you talk about making your body work in both directions?
Well, I never felt, I mean, that's funny because I didn't, I think it's something that happens inside too, that just kind of permeates. I think strong people, when you see someone and you go, that person's strong, very often it doesn't have anything to do with their physicality. You know, it has to do with something that's behind their eyes or something that's inside them that emanates, or some way that they move through a room or move through people. You just go, that guy is not to be messed with, or that guy is very forthright in his, you know, in his direction. There's just something that's very grounded about people like that. And for Buck, I really didn't think about doing anything physically for him. I just really sort of tried to feel kind of wrecked inside, you know, kind of like a house of cards inside that's very, it can be toppled, you know, real easily, and always trying to find, he's trying to always find that, you know, because he was a cowboy, then he had sort of his Earth, Wind, and Fire look, and, you know, and then he trotted out the whole Curtis Mayfield thing, the Sly Stone. I mean, he didn't know what, he had no idea what he wanted or who he was. The only thing he did know was that he wanted to have Buck's Super Stereo World, you know, that was very important to him, and that he was an actor. You know, he was a legitimate person. And that kind of thing, I don't know how that comes off physically, but that's what I was trying to work with him on the inside. And, you know, something like a part like Out of Sight or a part like, you know, Traffic, you go, oh, I'm going to be in a short T-shirt, and these guys probably do exercise, so I better, you know? It's just, that's just a basic, just go work out.
Don Cheadle is my guest, and he's starring in the new movie, The United States of Leland. A few years ago, you were in the HBO Rat Pack movie, playing the role of Sammy Davis Jr. Joe Mantegna was Dean Martin. Ray Liotta was Frank Sinatra. What did you think of Sammy Davis when you were young? Was he on your map at all? I mean,
he wasn't. He wasn't really on my map. The only time that he was on my map is when I would hear my parents and family talking about him, and not necessarily the most glowing of terms about what he represented at that time. You know, that was right around the time when I was growing up that he was, with Nixon, and, you know, there was that whole thing about him hugging Nixon, and that was a big flap, you know, in the community. And I just never really felt, from even seeing his performances, I thought, this dude is incredible. This dude is unbelievable performer. But as a person, he always seemed kind of slippery to me, you know? That's how I would always think of him, as this guy who's just too slick for school. But undoubtedly incredibly talented.
Did your opinion of him change when you played him?
I wouldn't say that my opinion of him changed, because it was never really that strongly formed. But I did learn more about him, what made him tick, from his own words, from his own viewpoint, which is also very interesting, you know, to see what he wrote about himself in his two books, you know. Yes, I Can, and I forget the name of his other book. But anyway, both of those books were very interesting. In as much as what he left out, you know, as what he put in, because there were some moments that I thought would have given rise to a lot of discussion about, you know, moments that he had with the Panthers and things that went down with he and Frank, things that you thought, well, obviously you're going to talk about your anger at this situation, or how you, like when he spoke about his anger to Frank, it never had anything to do with any sort of racial anything. It was about Frank's sort of pejorative viewpoint of his lifestyle, which, you know, he completely turned around. They didn't talk for many years together, and then the wives got them together and they sort of patched it up. But he never spoke about things that I thought he has to have some sort of feeling about, you know, what went down with those guys and sort of the, you know, the situations of being able to perform in places that you couldn't get in and your family had to come in the back door. And I mean, all of those things, I thought that those have to show up someplace emotionally in his book, and he never really dealt with them.
Did you do your own singing for the part?
In a couple of songs, yeah.
And did you try to get his voice?
Yeah, as close as I could. Yeah. On the live, the stage when we were singing the Hey There that we were doing live, mm-hmm, that was live.
Well, why don't we hear that song as performed in the Rat Pack movie? And this is Don Cheadle in the role of Sammy Davis.
Hey there.
Hey there. Hey, you want to laugh? Go sit on the audience. Got a show to do it.
You used to be too wise. Hey there.
What the hell is it, Sam?
Sing us another tune, Sander.
You think someday she'll run to you.
Better forget her.
Can't drink like this.
She'll have you dancing on a string. Break it and she won't care. Won't you take this advice? I hand you like a brother.
Your mother, you mother.
Well, geez, ladies and gentlemen, he said half a word.
After the show, you're going to hear the other half.
Booby, please.
Whoa, whoa, Zelda, Zelda, Zelda. Whoa, 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 whoa. I'll sing with you. I'll dance with you. I'll pick cotton with you. I'll even go to a bar mitzvah with you, but don't touch me.
Don Cheadle in Rat Pack, with Cheadle as Sammy Davis, and Joe Mantegna as Dean Martin, Ray Liotta as Frank Sinatra. Was it fun to be part of the Rat Pack, if only in the movies?
Oh, yeah. It was a lot of fun. I mean, whenever you have a fraternity like that, and everybody in the movie was cool to work with, you know. And in the movie, you know, Sammy twirls guns, and obviously he has to tap dance and sing, and plays the drums and, you know, plays the trumpet. It was like, Jesus, I gotta, like, you know, get all of this stuff down to a reasonable facsimile of believability. So every day it was great, because every day it was like I was back in school, because I had, you know, a drum tutorial at 11, and I had a trumpet, you know, session at 1, and then from 3 to 6 I was working with Savion Glover to get the tap dancing numbers down, and the next day I would have to do the gun twirling, and then, you know. So every day it was sort of this intensive Sammy Davis Jr. school, but it was great. It was great. It was a lot of fun. That's when it's really fun being an actor, because you get to sort of touch on all these different aspects of yourself and of other people that you normally wouldn't. You know, why would I ever be gun twirling? You know,
to hold a gun on somebody like you do so well.
Exactly. Another gun, another clip where I could just put Sammy in there twirling his gun.
Don Cheadle. He's starring in the new film, The United States of Leland. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, presenting the documentary The Trials of Henry Kissinger from filmmaker Eugene Jarecki, tonight at 7:30. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, The L Word. We talk with Eileen Chaykin, the creator of the Showtime series about a group of lesbian friends and lovers, and we meet one of the stars of the series, Jennifer Beals. The season finale is Sunday. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews a new book about the friendships between American writers, artists, and photographers in the years 1854 to 1967. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Showtime series The L Word concludes its first season on Sunday. It's the first TV series to focus on a group of lesbians and their friends and lovers. The series was recently renewed for a second season. My guests are Eileen Chaiken, the creator of The L Word, and Jennifer Beals, one of the stars. Beals' movies include Flashdance, Devil in a Blue Dress, Roger Dodger, and Runaway Jury. The L Word has been somewhat controversial because of its sexual content, but largely it's about relationships and some of the issues facing lesbians today. Jennifer Beals plays Bette, a museum director. Early in the series, she and her partner, Tina, agreed to have a baby. Then Tina tried to get pregnant with the help of a sperm donor, so they searched for just the right man. Bette, who is from a mixed-race family, found an African-American artist who was willing to be the donor, but she didn't mention to Tina, who is white, that he is black. So Tina was surprised and confused when she met him. Here she is with Bette after that meeting.
You put me in a f***ing awkward position. How could you not tell me that Marcus Allenwood is black?
God, I don't know. I guess I should have. I just didn't think it would be a problem for you to use a black donor.
But I didn't say I didn't want a black donor. I just think we should have discussed it.
We absolutely discussed it, Tina. Right in the very beginning, we said that if you were going to be the birth mother, that we should consider finding an African-American donor. That way, the child would be more like our child.
But I wasn't prepared.
I don't understand. Other than being committed to spending the rest of your life with me, what more do you need to do to prepare?
Look at me, Bette. I don't feel qualified to be the mother of a child who's half African American. I don't know what it means to be black.
I think I can make a contribution in that department.
And don't you think, on top of everything else, to also have two moms, that is a lot of otherness to put on one child.
I asked Jennifer Beals, who, like her character, is biracial, about dealing with the subject on the show.
One of the things this series does is it serves to represent people who don't often see themselves represented, and certainly not represented in a multiplicity. And I thought for myself, growing up, there weren't very many images, certainly none of them positive for me to see on television of people of mixed race. And I thought I was something that I wanted to give to someone else.
Had you played someone of mixed race before?
Oh, yes, but it's always sort of the tragic mulatto character,
mm-hmm.
which is not unlike the tragic homosexual character, you know, the person who is historically wrought with sexual perversion and ultimately, you know, their lives lead only to suicide. That's really sort of the original model.
I'm interested in the timing of this series. You wouldn't have known that this would happen. But The L Word has had its debut season in the same period that the whole issue of gay marriage has just become, you know, front page news, and it's in the courts. It's the president's talking about a constitutional amendment. Did you have any idea that coinciding with the first, you know, lesbian TV series like this, that's about a group of lesbian characters, that gay issues would be in the news in quite the way they are?
Certainly not when I began. I began developing this something like 4 years ago. It seems to me that there really is such a thing as a zeitgeist, that it all came about in one big moment in which all of these issues kind of conflated, has been intriguing, in some ways lucky for us because it focused even more attention on our show. When I began developing it, it still seemed like a risky outside proposition.
The main characters on The L Word are, without exception, quite attractive. And I wonder if you've been criticized for that, Eileen Chaiken, in the sense that I know, like, the sensible shoes, flannel shirt lesbian is a stereotype. But on the other hand, it's kind of undeniable that a lot of lesbian women aren't exactly fashion plates and aren't glamorous and you know, have kind of perfect figures and everything, just as like most straight women aren't that glamorous or have perfect figures either.
Like the women on Sex and the City.
Right, exactly, well, exactly. Most straight women don't look like Sex and the City. But nevertheless, I wonder if you've gotten flack from any lesbian women for not representing lesbian women who aren't, you know, gorgeous.
Everything that you can imagine might have been said has been said.
Right.
So, yes. Yes, I've gotten some flack. And at the same time, so many people have come forward and said how fabulous it is to be represented by beautiful women, or have commented that not everybody looks like the characters on Friends either. On television, we tend to cast people who are just a little bit better looking than the people we encounter in our day-to-day lives. But I think of these characters as very, very real.
Do you think there'll be a future episode where Bette finds the softball in her closet?
I think Bette's got a few flannel shirts hidden away.
I think she does too.
You know, I interviewed the writer Anne Bannon, who wrote a few of the lesbian pulp novels of the 50s. And she was saying that, you know, in that era, the covers of those lesbian pulps were for men. The idea was that the lesbian women would buy the books because there really was no other lesbian fiction, and they were really hungry for it. But the men would buy these pulps because, hey, there's two, like, sexy chicks on the cover, and men get turned on. Some men get turned on by the idea of two women having sex with each other. So I wonder if that's something, Eileen, that you thought about at all in how the series would be perceived.
I certainly thought about it in terms of how the series would be perceived. I didn't think about it in terms of how I put forward the stories I was telling. I think that those Anne Bannon books are a genre unto themselves. Whereas I always recognized that possibly, in fact, most likely, some straight men would come to this show because they found the idea of women together to be sexy, and that there would be a larger perception about that than the actual phenomenon itself. It isn't something I thought about when writing the stories. I didn't think, oh, I have to do that in order to appeal to those men. I didn't think, oh, I mustn't do that because I don't want to, stir up the wrong kind of excitement.
Jennifer, a lot of actors and actresses say that they really hate doing the love scenes. It's the most uncomfortable part of doing a movie. Is it any more uncomfortable when the sex scene is of a sexual orientation that you're not? Does that matter in terms of the comfort level?
Well, it's interesting because at first I didn't really consider the love scenes when I took the part and when I was researching the part. I was much more obsessed by the work that Bette did, because she was so obsessed by the work that she did. As a museum director. So I was busy researching what it takes to run a museum, and then along came this love scene that I had to shoot in about a week or so. And I thought, okay, how do I do this? And then I just started breaking it down as an actor. Not all love scenes are about love. I mean, sometimes they're about intimidation, sometimes they're about possession, sometimes they're about fear. And I realized that this scene was about Bette and Tina reconnecting after having a difficult period of time together. And when I broke it down that way, there was a scene to play. And every single thing, every single movement in the scene was choreographed, to the point where in the middle of the scene, Laurel Holloman, who plays Tina, just started laughing. She said, "I feel like Fred Astaire." And I'll tell you one thing. In some ways, it's easier to have a love scene with a woman because there are parts of your body that you are certainly less than thrilled with. At least there are parts of my body that I'm certainly less than thrilled with. And if I ask my scene partner to put their hand in a certain place to disguise something, men generally forget in the heat of the moment. Whereas a woman knows what that means.
That's
and she
really
doesn't
interesting.
Move her hand. because she knows that there will one day be a quid pro quo. So it's interesting. It's, you know, we do the scene and we laugh and talk about clothes.
Now, you said you wanted to do research, you know, about being a museum director. Did you feel any need to do research about, you know, being a lesbian in a love scene? Or is that something that...
Not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I figured I know how to love someone, and I know mm-hmm. how I like to be loved. So I think that was information enough. And when we were about to start the series, Rose Trochet put together a tape of love scenes, both homosexual and heterosexual, that she thought some of them worked and some of them didn't, and she wanted us to look at it and judge for ourselves what worked and why and what didn't work and why. And we watched the tape as a group, as the cast watched the tape together, and we really analyzed all these different scenes, and we realized that at the end of the day, when an actor was fearful, it was so clear, and it so interrupted the storytelling that we all vowed to one another that we would do our best to abandon any kind of fear and sort of dive headlong into these scenes, because otherwise you interrupt the story, and that's just not really forgivable.
My guests are Jennifer Beals, one of the stars of The L Word, and Eileen Chaiken, the creator of the series. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Eileen Chaiken, the creator of the Showtime series The L Word, about a group of lesbian friends and lovers, and Jennifer Beals, one of the stars of the series. Let's hear another scene from The L Word. The central characters are meeting for drinks, as they regularly do, and giving advice to their friend Alice, who they think is being used by her girlfriend. Jennifer Beals' character, Bet, speaks first.
It has to end. Seriously, Alice, you can't let Gabby continue to treat you this way.
You guys don't know her. I know it looks like she's treating me like but she's just, you know.
Treating you like
now. Maybe. It's just,
you know, it's just, you deserve better.
I do. All right, I do. But I just feel like at times she's like so right there and I feel like we connect and then all of a sudden she acts like I don't even exist.
That's because she's an emotional cripple. Yeah, emotional cripple / narcissistic personality disorder. And the next time she calls you, you have to end it.
I know.
It's just nothing. What are you gonna do?
Well, I was gonna ask her.
No asking. No, you're gonna tell her. You're gonna say, Gabby, I really enjoy the time we spent together, but it is obvious to me that we are in different places in our lives and we want different things out of a relationship. And I respect myself too much to let you continue to treat me this way. It's clear to me now that you are an emotional cripple without any kind of capacity to understand true love.
And I'm no longer willing to waste my valuable time on you.
So step off, bitch.
Eileen, I laughed when I read that you used to work for Aaron Spelling Productions because...
I laugh about that too
do
sometimes.
Do you? Okay. And, you know, Aaron Spelling produced shows like Fantasy Island, Love Boat, Love American Style, Beverly Hills 90210, Melrose Place... And they're all so in the kind of fantasy world, and where did you fit in that?
I actually worked for Aaron Spelling for a number of years, but during what I would have to confess was probably the most fallow time in his history as a television producer. There were no new shows on the air. It was just before Beverly Hills 90210. I was the only television show that I was involved in putting together that I actually like to talk about is Twin Peaks, which was actually a Spelling show. Nobody really remembers that it was distributed by Spelling. I know that I learned a great deal from Aaron Spelling, and he was fascinating to work for. I'm sure that I absorbed some lessons from that time. My approach to storytelling certainly isn't modeled after anything that he does, but I'm sure it seeped into me somehow.
Were you out at the start of your career in television?
Unwittingly. My partner and I have been together for 20 years, and we just always went everywhere together, and I never made big declarations about being a lesbian, but I think that it just sort of came to be understood.
Did it affect your career in any way?
I'm sure it did from time to time.
It's hard to tell, right?
It's hard to tell. I know that there were moments when I felt very much on the outside because people were uncomfortable with me, because I simply wasn't one of them. But I don't think that I was ever, with maybe one small exception, overtly discriminated against for being a lesbian.
And what was that exception?
It was a moment, and I won't get specific about it, but a moment when a very powerful executive and I butted heads over a business issue, and he called me up and threatened to out me.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was kind of mystified by it because I was already out.
So what did you say?
I was tongue-tied. I was kind of horrified and frightened, not because I thought he was going to out me, because that wouldn't have been of any consequence, but just because somebody much bigger and more powerful than me was obviously really angry with me, and he saw fit to threaten me. He took the time to call me on the phone and tell me that he was going to make an issue of my sexuality.
Did you stay working with him?
I had no choice.
Meaning, he fired you, or meaning that you stayed?
No, meaning he wasn't in a position to directly fire me. He possibly could have gotten me fired if he had wanted to. But he didn't fire me, and I had to go on working with him.
Right. Jennifer Beals, I want to ask you, I know you're probably really tired of talking about Flashdance, but I'm curious, you know, you started your career right out of high school. Am I right?
Right.
And you get this part in a movie that, like, becomes a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of leave acting for a while and go to college.
Well, I loved school. It's very simple. I really loved school. And I loved university. And to me, getting the little blue book to take my test was really exciting. The
no.
moment that they handed out the blue books.
I hated those books.
I was
books.
Very excited. There was a slight terror, but it was overcome by excitement. So I knew that I would go back to college. That was never an issue. And I just knew that I loved reading. I loved being in class. I was good at it. And I think in some kind of Skinner way, I just went to where I was being rewarded most often. And I went back to school and then started working again, I think my senior year.
Well, I think Skinner would have noticed that you were rewarded quite well for being in Flashdance financially and all the other materialistic ways, fame.
Right, but I think that Skinner would have also noted that from the time of junior kindergarten through my freshman year in college, I'd been rewarded all that time for academics. So,
right.
And there were times in Hollywood where it was very difficult because I was very shy. And so I was very quiet on the set. And I didn't realize at that time that when you're the lead of the movie, you're also the hostess of the party. Nobody told me that. So I spent a lot of time in my trailer and... I was reading Durkheim's Suicide, I think, at the time, because it was just so, it was very, very lonely. I mean, I loved Adrian Lyne, I loved the script and a lot of the people I worked with, but for the most part, I was really, really shy and really quiet and didn't know anybody. So school was truly a haven.
And how does that shyness affect you now as an actress?
Every now and again it comes up. When I'm at parties with other actors, I get very shy. When I meet athletes whom I admire, I get shy. But I, on the set, it's much easier. You know, it's much easier because I realize that all of us are making the film. All of us are making the TV series. It's not just me. It's not just another actor. It's not just the director. And I really love the group effort. I love the idea that it takes a village, and I love the magic of film. So I have such high esteem for all of the people that I work with, all of the technicians, all of the other actors, that it's much easier for me now.
Do you like to dance a lot?
Not really.
Is it a, do people assume that you do because of Flashdance?
You know what's interesting is that I learn a lot about the person from what film they reference when they meet me.
Right.
Some people talk about Flashdance. Some people want to talk about Devil in a Blue Dress.
Right.
I had a guy on the subway not long ago quoting long passages from Vampire's Kiss. And somebody came up to me at the gym just 2 days ago about Roger Dodger. So it's interesting. I think people have different images of me from different films.
You've gotten the green light for a new season of The L Word. Are you both pleased that that it's going to continue?
I think we're both pretty happy about it. I speaking for myself, would love to go on telling these stories for some time to come.
Yes, Granny Bet. Then maybe we could break out a flannel robe.
I want to keep telling these stories until Bette gets as old as me.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Eileen Chaykin is the creator of the Showtime series The L Word. Jennifer Beals plays the character Bette. This season's finale will be shown on Sunday. The L Word has been renewed for another season. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews the new book, A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists, 1854 to 1967. This is Fresh Air. The novelist Willa Cather once said that sometimes entering a new door can make a great change in one's life. That quote could serve as the motto for Rachel Cohn's new book, A Chance Meeting, which is about the often accidental real-life friendships among American writers, artists, and photographers from the Civil War to the 1960s. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Rachel Cohn's book, A Chance Meeting, is in no way naive or fusty. So I'm not damning it with faint praise when I say that the word that kept running through my mind as I was reading it was charming. Cohen sets out to trace the sometimes obscured history of friendships between American writers, artists, and photographers in the period 1854 to 1967. In 36 short, often poignant essays, she focuses on the fateful encounters between, among others, Henry James and Matthew Brady, Mark Twain and Willa Cather, Willa Cather and Edward Steichen and Catherine Ann Porter, and on until the later breathless pairings of W.E.B. Du Bois and Charlie Chaplin and John Cage and Marcel Duchamp. The dizzying effect here is like watching a Twilight Zone square dance in which James Baldwin do-si-dos with Norman Mailer, who then twirls away to switch partners with Marianne Moore. Sometimes what's being exchanged as these luminaries grasp hands is nothing more than palm sweat and casual greetings. But other times there's an electric shock of recognition that marks the passing on of an artistic inheritance, a star-spangled spark of distinctly American genius. That's what's so charming about Cohen's book. She intelligently reaffirms the importance of the lives of writers and artists, particularly their friendships, to their art. Postmodern deconstructive irony is barred from this dance hall. That's not to imply that A Chance Meeting is just a chattier version of, say, those biographical essays that introduced the selections in the Norton Anthology of Literature. For one thing, Cohen calls upon critical history, gossip, and scrupulously delineated fictional guesswork to flesh out the relationships here. And Cohen's canon of crucial American cultural figures is more eccentrically inclusive than any you would find in a traditional anthology. In her introduction, Cohen says that she chose the 30 people she did because they were all city dwellers who spent a lot of time visiting and writing letters to each other, and because she felt she had an instinct for their company. So she sometimes skips over superstars like Hemingway and Fitzgerald to focus on minor, fascinating figures who turn out to be at the center of a web of intersecting friendships. Annie Adams Fields is one of these revelations, a poet and essayist who befriended Nathaniel Hawthorne, Harriet Beecher Stowe, and William Dean Howells. She was the wife of the publisher of the Atlantic Monthly, and after his death, the intimate companion of novelist Sarah Orne Jewett. By the way, Cohen discusses the now overlooked writings of Howells, Jewett, and others with such passion that I found myself adding to that ever-swelling must-read list that I and so many other readers guiltily carry around in our heads. Throughout the course of her book, Cohen also revisits familiar company like Walt Whitman, Gertrude Stein, and Robert Lowell. Judiciously citing sentences from their correspondence and diaries, Cohen restores a sense of human, all too human emotions lurking within these icons. Grousing about old age, Whitman wrote that he was, each successive fortnight, getting stiffer and stuck deeper, much like some hard-cased, dilapidated, grim ancient shellfish. Grousing about the garrulous wife of his friend, William Dean Howells, Mark Twain wrote in a letter to his wife that when Eleanor Howells entered the room, dialogue died and monologue inherited its assets. Cohen is no slouch with a pen herself. Describing Ulysses S. Grant, she says, he was shy, taciturn, and self-assured, qualities that were frequently mistaken for each other. Through the elegance of her own writing and the conviction of her interpretations, Cohen here fashions an alternative descent line of American artists and writers linked not just by creative influence, but by letters of introduction, drunken encounters at parties, decades of correspondence, notes of constructive criticism and encouragement, cards containing much-needed cash. A chance meeting is the history of intertwined friendships, but it's also the history of a virtue that's often thought to be in short supply among ambitious people. It's the history of a generosity of spirit.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Chance Meeting by Rachel Cohen. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Whisker of Evil, A Mrs. Murphy Mystery by Rita Mae Brown and Sneaky Pie Brown, authors of The Tale of the Tip-Off. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Last month, the Israeli military assassinated the spiritual leader of Hamas. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Johanna Magiri, Time Magazine's chief foreign correspondent, about her recent article, Inside Hamas. She has interviewed several leaders of the group. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.